On this episode of Teched Out by Full Stack Academy, Corey and I explore the origins of computers. How did laziness and the 1880 census lead to the development of the iPhone? If you haven't checked out our episode on understanding data, it might give you a greater appreciation for parts of what we talk about here.
Coffee burp.
It's a coffee burp?
Coffee burp, yeah. You
know, is that coffee burp? Is that worse than like... Isn't it just like acid reflux?
Maybe. I have not consulted a doctor about it.
You probably should.
I'm now a little bit concerned.
That's like, definitely acid reflux, right? It's like... Anyway.
It's like a cutesy name for something that maybe is a little bit more
serious. Coffee burps? No,
it's... too serious. It's not like having a heart attack every once in a while and calling it like... Chesty pains.
Chesty pains. Let's start by talking about why we code, right? We often have spent a lot of our time here talking about like parts of it. Like we talked about the internet and sort of how that, affects us today. And but it goes back much further than the internet, right? Like the idea of using machines to solve problems is a, centuries old issue. Yeah.
Millennial problem. Right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's like humans in general, like yeah. Using tools to solve problems.
The wheel. How long has the wheel been around?
A long time. It's probably, the circular wheel was a great...
They had wheels in the Flintstones, so...
Yeah, it's...
It's got to be a long time.
Right, exactly. But yeah. All right, that's great. So... Let's talk about like, maybe modern kind of where people started to think about machines to solve kind of calculations or where we can put in some kind of input, do some performant operation, and then get some output. Like, where did this kind of begin,
Yeah, that sounds like a good place to start. So I guess one thing to talk about is this idea that humans don't like work, right? Do you like work?
Not entirely, but yeah. I happen to like my job.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So I like work when it doesn't feel like work.
Right.
But when it feels like I'm really struggling, putting in a lot of effort for the amount that I'm getting out of it, not a great feeling. Right.
So it kind of sounds like what you're getting at is like humans like being lazy.
Yeah. Or humans just are lazy.
Right.
Right. We're just lazy.
Yeah.
That's the idea with machines in general and tools, really, right? Like, think about a lever. A lever is just a way that you can put in way less effort to get the same exact job done. And really, code and computers in general are just big levers that we're pulling all the time so that we can do the minimal amount of work, think a little bit, type some stuff in our keyboard, and then a whole bunch of stuff can actually happen
right
after that. And we can automate it.
Right.
So... when did we first start to see machines like this that could kind of automate processes? Or who came up with the idea, I guess, for machines like this?
So, I mean, there's arguments that it goes as far back as Da Vinci. But,
did he invent the first computer in his little sketchbook
right,
thing there?
Was right,
there
like just a, like the first helicopter,
picture
right?
of a MacBook Pro.
The MacBook Pro was actually designed, designed in California.
Just ripped everybody off, including Da Vinci.
It was Da Vinci's work in the 1700s that provided the way for the MacBook Pro. But the first person it's like really attributed to is Charles Babbage. Back in the 1840s, he came up with this idea for the difference engine. And remember, back at this time, like electricity wasn't, there was no party at Edison's house yet, right? So it was pre-electrical days, and this machine's capabilities, which wasn't actually built, it was a sketch of plans to actually build this machine,
required... like a lot of Da Vinci's sketches.
Like a lot of Da Vinci's. Right.
He came up with the idea, just never actually built it.
Right. Exactly. Okay. But it was a series of switches that you could physically move, and the combinations of these switches would provide unique operations. You could switch two things down and perform an add operation, for example. We had talked in one of our earlier episodes about data, right, and how we can represent everything at some level by using ones and zeros, right? With enough ones and zeros, with enough ons and offs, we can represent things. This is even true for logical operations. We can say with enough combinations of ons and off switches, with enough ones and zeros, we can actually start to do mathematical operations like add, subtract, divide, and the complications of these things create circuitry.
Interesting. So you're talking about switches here, right? And this was a machine that was never built, but the design of this difference engine that Charles Babbage came up with this was, you said 1840s before Edison. So this was not electrical switches.
Correct. Right?
We're talking about mechanical switches here, like levers sort of that get switched from one position to another.
Exactly. And so we could provide input by changing the combinations of those switches, therefore changing the mechanics of this machine, right, and creating some output. And this, by the way, this was replicated from these designs fairly recently, actually, and validated to work. So we know that this could operate like we think of modern machinery. So we do attribute it to being not the first computer because it wasn't truly electrical, but the first like programmatic machine.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. And so if there was a machine that you're saying could be programmed by turning these switches on and off, were there programmers at that point or did we have to wait a while for that?
Right. And I mean, of course, there weren't programmers like we think of today, right? Like having code sitting on a machine ready to be executed, right? Mm-hmm. But really, in reality, any program is just like a set of operations to perform some action, right? That's all it is.
Right.
And so someone at the time named Ada Lovelace, who worked closely with Charles Babbage, wrote what we consider today the first computer program, quote unquote. It was called Note G. And it was basically the correct switch ordering that you could put these switches in to calculate what's known as Bernoulli numbers. It's just a thing in
Bernoulli numbers. Yeah, obviously.
Very classic, right? Mathematical. Probably, yeah. It probably is.
Who doesn't really know Bernoulli numbers?
Probably our listeners are like, these guys are idiots. They don't know. I don't know. But it was cool because, again, it was a schematic on how we could organize our switches in a certain way to produce unique outputs. And we could do some computational work. And again, these schematics that weren't actually testable then were proven later. So we know that this would have actually worked.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So Ada Lovelace was actually writing computer programs. Well, maybe not computer programs, but some kind of program. I guess you could think of it as a computer, right? Mm-hmm. So she was sort of the first programmer then, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
Even if her programs weren't ever actually running on a machine just yet.
Exactly.
A little ahead of her time.
Exactly. But so we it's hard to call her a computer programmer when it wasn't really considered to be a computer, right? And there was a while, there's a whole history here that, you know, like we're talking 1840s here, and the first real computer didn't come out till the mid-1900s. But that wasn't like the end of like computational desire, right? Like, you know, every 10 years in the United States, a census is taken to calculate how many people are eating our food or whatever. I don't know. Maybe that's not why they do it. I don't know. Starvation and stuff, and it's getting dark.
Yeah, just figuring out how many people live here, I think.
Yeah, it seems important.
Idea. Yeah, right.
It seems, maybe it's important. I don't know. Is it that important?
I'm told it's important.
I'm told. Yeah. We're getting worried.
Budgets and stuff, right?
Imports. I don't know.
Exports.
Exports. Tariffs? I don't know.
Politics.
Politics. So, so the late 1800s, 1880 census, the census of 1880 was a really tough census because it almost took 10 years. It took about 8 years to complete a census. And you have a census every 10 years. So that sounds like a problem, doesn't it? Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
If you have, it does.
Like, they're like, oh, shoot, the population is growing big enough in 1880 where it almost took us to 1890 to actually count up the number of people. So doing this surveying, doing this calculation is becoming very, very, very difficult by hand. We could use some sort of machine to conquer this. And this actually arose at the beginning of what's known as tabulating machines. Tabulating machines.
Tabulating is like counting, of, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, again, kind of getting back to this idea of sort of laziness, right? We have these people who were counting census records by hand. They were trying to figure out how many people lived in the country just by doing calculations, I assume, on sheets of paper and pencil kind of thing, right? And instead of working harder, somebody had to say, let's make it easier for everybody, right? Let's automate this process a little bit. Let's build a machine, a sort of lever that we can pull that makes our jobs a little bit easier.
Right. And even became questionable whether or not we could even work harder. Like, that's what's really interesting about the development of computers is they do things at performance levels that humans physically could not do, right? And so these tabulating machines early on were a series of, like, punch card systems, right? Where you would imagine, like, having a metal plate, right? And if you were to run a piece of metal and touch the metal plate, it would produce, like, some kind of electrical current, right? So you have a metal plate and you put a, you know, an electrical wire on that electrical plate, and you would be able to get a current. But if you put something that's like non-conductive in the middle, like wood or paper, right, or a punch card that was maybe unpunched, right, you would not be able to get the current from that wire to that metal plate.
It would block the electrical current from flowing, right? Right. If we just had a piece of paper or a thin cardboard or something, it would block it.
Correct. Gotcha. And so, and again, it's like low-level currents here. We're just trying to detect if there's a signal. And so what's really nice about this is if we can somehow now punch holes through that cardboard, if the metal wires, like almost like sweep like a brush over this metal plate, wherever the metal actually contacts the plate, we can say that there is some data, right? Because if there's a punch card, we can punch out a piece of that cardboard, a piece of that paper, allowing electrical current to conduct in one particular location, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, so this is a way that you can kind of write things into a card by punching holes in it and allow a machine, like this tabulating machine or a computer of some kind, to be able to read the data off of it. Right.
Yeah.
So you can actually code programs into punch cards. Is that what you're telling me?
Essentially, yeah. You can do complex mathematical combinations, calculations. You can even represent data in some sort. And so, because you can represent data, you can start to program. You know.
Again, getting back to this idea of if you can represent an either or kind of thing, a binary unit of information, a bit, then you can just combine that in infinitely complex ways and represent anything you want, right? So we had Ada Lovelace a few decades before this writing computer programs or writing programs using mechanical switches that were being flipped this way or that way. And now we're at the point where we're starting to use punch cards. Maybe a little bit less work intensive, I guess, than flipping all these switches. You can just punch things out.
Right. And but these machines also, they weren't like dynamic in what they were capable of doing. They were built to perform some sort of operation, either adding or multiplying or some basic operations. They weren't as complex as what we think of as machines today, or even in some cases like what the difference engine or analytic engine was capable of doing. These tabulating machines were very good at completing a particular task. In fact, the creator of it, there was a lot of drama on the scene. There was a lot of drama back in the U.S. Census of 1890s. And
you don't got to tell me.
You don't got to.
I remember that season of Jersey Shore.
What a bad joke. Anyway.
We can cut that.
Yeah. I'm not gonna cut that. That's gonna be in there.
Great.
But there was a lot of drama. Anyway, the creator of the original tabulating machine like ended up like overcharging the U.S. government, and there was a lot of drama. Ended up leaving and starting after a bunch of changes, starting a company. What we know as today is International Business Machines or IBM.
Yeah, I've heard of them.
Yeah, so it's pretty interesting how that came out. So we had the analytic difference engine, this mechanical system in the 1840s with Charles Babbage and Ada Lovelace with her computer program. We had in the mid 1880s, end of the 19th century, we had the beginning of these tabulating machines. But it took a while to get to what we think of as modern computers. And so what happened? Like, what made the first computer? What did it take to be a computer versus just some kind of machine?
Yeah, that's a good question. So you're talking about this idea of the tabulating machine being very single purpose, right? It kind of has a one-track mind. All it knows how to do is add things, essentially, count things up, right? So it takes one kind of input and produces one kind of output. So when I think of a computer today, when I think of my laptop, it can do just about anything I want it to do. And if it can't do that thing that I want it to do, then I can write a program that makes it do that thing, right? Mm-hmm. So it can sort of calculate anything or perform almost any kind of operation you can imagine. Is that what you're getting at? This idea that computers are flexible and that they're sort of almost automatic thinking machines in a way.
Right, yeah. And so we saw big changes in these mechanical machinery in the early 1900s as well. And this dynamic circuitry, this idea that like, okay, we can actually put these ons and offs. We can put these signals in particular sequences to create certain operations. And even combining those operations at a greater level allows us to do more and more and more things. So it turns out there's a way to not only represent these physical gateways with switches that are on and off physically, but now, come the mid-1900s and come the first computer, we were able to represent these signals and these gates and these circuits electronically. We were able to take what's known as a transistor. We were able to create these electrical systems that allowed us to create unique combinations, allowed us to do these logical calculations.
Right. So at this point, we're talking about the ability to not just perform a couple operations on some input data, but we can actually maybe store data in the machine itself, right? We have computer memory, and we have the ability to have a machine remember a computer program, like remember a process that it can execute as many times as we want it to with different inputs, right?
Well, that's a really good point. Someone by the name of von Neumann came up with this idea of architecture, right? Like, you know, you've probably heard about all these terms inside your computer, but like they weren't all there, right? Like we didn't always have a video card in our computer. We didn't always have like a sound card in our computer. We didn't always have these devices, right? And so even early on, these machines would take some input, do some operation, perform some output. And if we wanted to use that output to like combine with some other input, we would physically need to take that output, re-put it in physically as input, and then run another calculation, right? But now, with the addition of memory, with the addition of some of these things early on, we were able to create more complex operations by using temporary electronic storage. As long as we could take our result, but not put it into our output box, but put it into our memory holding box, and say, you know what, take that thing from the memory box again, and combine that in our next operation, we were now able to, without physically having to re-input that stuff, store things and use things. And that was really cool with early on data and memory.
That is pretty cool. And that's what's known as the von Neumann architecture there, right? The fact that computers could kind of store their own programs, store some data temporarily in one bucket, right? They kind of just have different buckets internally almost, right? And it's like, I'm going to add these two numbers together. I'm going to get the result. It's the number 8. I'm just going to store it over here for later on because I'm going to end up dividing by that 8 later on or something like that, right? It's like I can use this later.
Yeah. And so this first machine wasn't all that crazy, right? Like, it was huge. It was huge. It was 1,800 square feet. And, like, I can't even tell you, like, we live in New York City, right?
So yeah, that's, like, 6 apartments.
That's, like, 6 apartments, like, right there. Not even, like, the exaggeration. That's, like, 6, like, you know.
1,800 square feet. I don't even know what that looks like.
It's, like, 6 studios, like, shoebox studios, wow, probably. But that's still a ton of room, like, and so much room dedicated for cooling. The early machines had something like 18,000 transistors, 18,000 ones and zeros, which might sound like a lot, right? But the ones in our machines today are on the order of billions of these combinations. So 18,000 wasn't that particularly amazing, but it did allow us to do everything that we were doing physically before. Now, electronically, we can say, take things from this input, take things from this input, add them together and put them out in this output box.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And you're talking about transistors here, which is what we see in computers now, right? Computers today are using transistors. They have for a long time since, as you mentioned, the mid-20th century. When John von Neumann was working on these computers originally, were they always transistors? I remember there being sort of vacuum tubes was a thing that I heard about, right? These giant computers with like all these light bulb looking things all over the place.
You're absolutely right. The original computers do not have these transistors, and that's actually my mistake. That's really good. They had these big tubes, these big like I don't know if you've ever seen like a guitar amplifier. They're used still in like audio electronics a lot. But they basically have an internal, I believe, anode, and it can produce electricity and current and that would go to the outside cathode. And so this would be on if that electricity was flowing, or off if it was not, which was pretty cool. So they had these giant vacuum tubes. And what's bad about giant electrical lights, essentially, is that if one breaks, you need to open up this thing, find the broken one, and replace it, right?
Yeah, right. That sounds like a real pain. Right. And that was happening all the time, right? These vacuum tubes were shorting out. There were people whose full-time jobs, basically, were like maintaining this stuff, going around and changing out tubes, changing light bulbs, essentially,
right,
was these people's job. Yeah. But Transistors then became a big step forward, partially because they don't break down the same way, but also because they're quite a bit smaller, right?
Right, exactly. And so transistors were like, remember, all we really need to be a electrical state machine is to be able to have a current or not have a current, right? And so transistors met this requirement. And I think they were produced by Bell Labs kind of late 1940s, I believe. And they severely decreased the size needed to represent these things, decreased the amount of energy that was needed to run these machines. So we started to see computing sort of break out. But again, we still had to like physically tell the architecture, even though like it was electronically changing, we could still like, you know, make electrical circuits internally that would perform some sort of operations. We still would have to say like, go into this systematic format, go into this direction, operate this way, take things from register one or input one and take things from input two, add them, put them into input three, right?
It was very manual process, it sounds like, right? We were still kind of moving switches on and off, right? We were punching holes in cards, not literally though, right? We were just changing whether electricity was flowing at this part or this other part, right? We were coding in ones and zeros, essentially, but in a little bit more advanced way.
Exactly.
With more powerful machines, we were coding in ones and zeros.
And we were coding in ones and zeros. And people at the time were like, this is pretty terrible, right? Like, this idea of having to write actual ones and zeros that were not very, again, human tangible. We spent a lot of time going over that data episode because it's not very clear how to think in ones and zeros, especially when we start saying like, okay, this set of ones and zeros now is not even going to represent a number, but it's going to represent like an input device.
Yeah.
Right?
It's like another language, right? It's like learning another language where there are only two characters. Like imagine English if there was only A and B.
Right.
That'd be really hard to read.
Exactly.
If we only had A and B and just like weird combinations of A's and B's together.
Right. Yeah, and it gets very complicated very quickly.
Right.
So there came this idea that, well, what if we didn't do this? Because at the end of the day, the machine needs these instructions, right? We have to feed the machine in ones and zeros. It's the only thing it's going to understand.
Right.
But instead of us writing it like that, what if we put a step in between? What if we can write something that's more readable, more human-friendly? And then we'll go through a process. And that process, at the end of the day, is going to produce those ones and zeros that the machine needs.
Interesting. So we can speak one language, right? We can write programs one way, but then have it translated somehow along the way into ones and zeros, which is the computer's language that it understands.
Right. And yeah. So early on, the first attempt at this was something known as assembly, right? An assembly is basically a wrapper, a thin wrapper around this machine language, right? Instead of having to specify, you know, in ones and zeros exactly the operation, you'd have the first part of your code segment, you would write the input device, and then you'd write the second input device, and then you'd write the operation, and then you'd write the target output, the area. But it still was not very readable. It was like numerical. It was still very basic, you know?
Right. And it was a big step forward, I think, at the time, right? Because we had this machine code that everybody was writing in, just ones and zeros. And if you wanted to write computer programs in machine code, you had to remember, okay, this exact sequence of ones and zeros is how you add two numbers together, right? With assembly, you could sort of just start to tell it, okay, take some input from here and some other number from here, and you can use like an add word in assembly. And it starts to look a little bit more like English, the way we would describe programs, right? And this kind of makes me think of a couple things here. First of all, it gets back to this idea that we started with, that humans are lazy. It's a little bit easier to just write things in a language that's closer to the one we already know and have someone else take care of translating it,
right?
And it's probably going to get more work done in the end if we don't have to keep thinking, okay, what's the exact sequence of ones and zeros to add something or multiply things together? We can just remember these kind of abstractions, I guess, on top of machine code. So assembly is sort of an abstraction over machine code.
Yeah.
And the other thing that it makes me think of is not only are humans lazy, but we only have a limited amount of brain power and focus, right? We're just apes, ultimately. And if we're solving problems but devoting a lot of our mental efforts, a lot of our brain power to remembering stupid things like specific sequences of ones and zeros, and taking a lot of time between thoughts to code these things out in that very manual way, we're taking a lot of power away from our problem-solving capabilities, right? And so we're sort of knocking off two things here. We're kind of killing two birds with this introduction of a sort of higher-level version of programming, a more abstract version like assembly.
Right. And I think that this is the paradigm, and I think we should keep talking about this. I think we should talk about kind of what this leads into. And that's something really, really powerful, right? Like, we have this idea right now that we can abstract. And as long as we have a process of going back to what the computer can understand, we can continually abstract to make things more readable by humans.
Yeah, yeah, that's a very powerful idea.
If you're enjoying our show, we want to ask you to please like, rate, share, review, favorite, applaud, Instagram, tweet, I don't know, whatever you can do on your current podcast platform, please do that. Thank you so much, and thanks for listening.